GSIP's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to Sophia Gaston. Sophia is a director of the British Foreign Policy Group and a research fellow at the London School of Economics and Political Science and the European Policy Centre here in Brussels. She was previously with Demos and is an expert on many things related to populism, nationalism, nostalgia, public opinion, and European political developments. Sophia and I are going to talk about these subjects exactly, but I also want to enlist her help to better understand current developments in British politics. Before we start, I should say that in the middle of the podcast, you will hear a difference in sound of Sophia's voice. We had a technical issue and lost a minute in one of her answers. We only saw this after recording, but Sophia was kind to re-record that minute for us. Now, on to the podcast. Sophia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I mean, we're going to talk about several different things during this conversation, but I want to start off with this broad populist nationalist challenge that we've had in Europe and the West over the past couple of years. And what I want to ask you about is basically, what's your view on where we stand right now with this populist nationalist challenge? On the one hand, you can say that after the European Parliament election, many people, including myself, I think, have basically concluded that, well, you know, it didn't go as bad as we feared. The process in Brussels after the European Parliament election has also showed that it's going to be extraordinarily difficult for many of these parties to actually have any real influence on the shape of policy, even if at least some of them claim that they had a significant influence on choosing the new Commission president. If we look around Europe, we have a new government in Italy, where Matteo Salvini is not part of it anymore, and we are sort of back to a little bit more of a centrist policy in Italy, even if the new government also include the five-star movement. So would you agree that we perhaps not has reached peak populism, but at least that we have a development where we have calmed things down politically in Europe and perhaps more broadly the West, and that we don't need to panic anymore and fear that whatever happens or whatever election that is going to come up in the near future is going to deliver even more bad news when it comes to populism and nationalism and their increasing influence in European parliaments.
So I think part of the reason that it does feel a little bit as though things have calmed down now is that we did see concern around populism reaching a kind of fever pitch in the wake of 2016 and of course around the big ticket elections in the year after in 2017. I think it was natural that the attention on populism escalated so dramatically because people felt shocked. They really had felt taken by surprise, and as if all the received wisdom of our political systems had been challenged. I think many of the predictions at that point really did feel diabolical, and that's partly because politicians and journalists in particular, I think, just felt so powerless. There is an innate quality to populism that is challenging to these traditional power dynamics. It's a kind of flagrancy with the truth, an absence of shame, the fostering of conspiratorial narratives. And all of these make it really difficult to hold these politicians to account without further amplifying their reach and impact. I do agree that over the past year, we've started to see a little bit of optimism developing within Europe that perhaps things might be settling. There's, of course, as you say, been some victories for the traditional parties nationally and also in some of the major cities. The EU elections, of course, ultimately sort of allowed the traditional leaders to once again sort of serve as the architects of the major appointments for the next parliamentary term. But I do think that if you dig even just a little bit beneath the surface, the threats are still very much present. And I would say that the wolves of populism still very much stand at Europe's door. I think in many ways, of course, actually, you can read the EU elections as more of the next phase of the normalization of populist parties. They're clearly very much part now of the EU's furniture. Any sort of idea that they were a flash in the pan, I think has been proven wrong. Then if you look, just say, for example, to France, you know, Marine Le Pen there continues to hold appeal for a very significant part of the population. And you mentioned Italy, of course, Salvini, yes, has been sort of thwarted by the new coalition government. But he does remain tremendously popular among citizens, and of course his anti-establishment message is undented. The other thing, of course, is that you do have a number of countries where populist leaders had taken control on a national level. Their presence is really not new anymore. They've been in power for quite some years now. They've had ample time now to challenge, you know, whether it's the independence of the courts, to suppress freedom of the press, and reduce the pathways to power for sort of other opposition candidates. And that does change the nature of the electorate psychologically. So I think there is very much still a populist specter hanging over Europe. And of course, its other bedfellow, which is sort of polarization and indeed fragmentation. I think the combination of these really do continue to present significant challenges to liberal governance in Europe and the West more generally.
What do you, Sophia, make of the argument that on the one hand, we can sort of talk about the nationalist populist challenge in the form of the growth of the parties that we're talking about, the growth of leaders like Matteo Salvini and others that have been riding the wave of populism over the past couple of years. Another way to look at it is how established parties are responding to that challenge. And there are different opinions out there on this issue, where there are some who are making the claim that, well, you know, it's no better that the populists are declining, or that they may not be creating as much panic anymore, when so much of the established political landscape has taken over. Part of the messages that they were delivering, and that many of these established parties are also finding new opportunities to behave very opportunistically and to step away from sort of some sort of centrist position where we had norms and agreements about what a civilized political discourse would constitute. So this argument would basically be that, well, you know, both the center left and the center right have gradually been moving in a direction of these political parties. So even if they're going to reduce their own significance, we're still going to be left with the problem that the essence and the content of what they were proposing, it's very much alive in European politics.
I think if you look back to sort of the early days of the kind of mainstreaming consciousness of populism in advanced liberal democracies, so if we just sort of think about 2014, 15 and so on, just before the big shocks of 2016, I think really our understanding of populism at that time was very much of a force that could win without winning. They were these sort of forces that were outside of the mainstream institutional structure of our political systems. They were still very much outside rattling the cage. And in many ways, that was where they were most comfortable. Their entire sort of communication strategy positioned them as outsiders. And I think what we started to see in 2016, and one could say also, of course, in 2015 in places like Poland and so on, it's been a sort of gradual and very asymmetrical process, of course, across Europe. But what we have seen subsequently is a number of these parties assuming a much more significant role electorally and in terms of their electoral significance, partly because their rise has come at the expense of generally the two major parties on the center left and the center right, and their sort of stranglehold over the electorate. The rise of populism is also the story of the rise of fragmentation, moving from these big behemoths that were broad churches to a much more sort of direct form of representative democracy in our political systems. The formation of a greater number of coalitions and a much more sort of divisive and I suppose weak governing structure overall. So I think that's one way in which just structurally populist parties have had tremendous influence over our political systems, because of course as well, on the other side of things, you do see the rise of a lot of counter movements as well, and these are often not coming within the traditional centre-left parties, for example. They are actually coming from other parties within that sort of left sphere, whether that's the Greens or other sort of types of kind of more liberal democratic parties. You mentioned in terms of messages, I think this is incredibly important. They have really thrust a number of issues onto the policy agenda of the major parties. The parties have been forced to respond, and they've taken a number of different pathways, and they're all quite inconsistent and with inconsistent results. So some of the major parties have just completely adopted the positions of these populist parties to their right or to the left. Right. Others have sought to form productive coalitions of governance with them, as we saw in Austria, of course, that didn't go so well for either of them in the end. Others have just been more influenced in a direction, sort of either way, or just whether to take an issue more seriously. Much more important, and I think sort of an issue that probably has less attention around the rise of populist parties, is just how they've actually injected a populist framework around our political communications. And that influences not just politicians and the political parties, but also the media. And it becomes very difficult, particularly if this sort of populist framework has been set out or aided and abetted by a party with quite significant electoral influence and visibility, does become very difficult for opposition parties to actually resist themselves falling into that framework. And this is why you're so often seeing even traditional parties for whom populism would have been absolutely anathema to their traditional campaigning approach, you're starting to see them picking up some of these elements of the populist communication style. So I do think we need to consider the influence of populist parties on a number of levels. There's structurally, there's electorally, there's also their kind of policy influence, but also the way in which they have completely reshaped conception and understanding of political communications.
I think that's also a pretty good segue into the British election, right? So we have a development there which I find increasingly difficult to read from the outside. When I follow British politics, both before the decision came that the country was going to have a new general election, and the sort of debate that we've seen emerging ever since then, it's just very sort of difficult to interpret exactly what type of fight that the political parties would like to have. In one way, it's easy. I mean, it's pretty obvious that the Conservative Party wants to fight the party on the issue of Brexit. But it's not just them, but a few others as well, that I get the feeling that they are beginning to behave a bit unreasonable when it comes to messaging and broadly being able to deliver a message that could appeal to an audience which is sort of outside their immediate constituencies and their immediate supporters. So what do you think, what is this election campaign and the issues that they are trying to raise in the UK right now? What is that telling us about the direction of politics in the UK?
Well, this is a very strange election, because I do think on one level, you actually do kind of have both of the major parties sort of not wanting it to be about Brexit. And then you do have a number of smaller parties who've really sort of have the potential to gain a lot more attention, visibility, and potentially even seats than we've seen for some time. All of these smaller parties desperately trying to make it all about Brexit. But in any case, there's no getting around it. Brexit is the reason we're having this election. Brexit will be dominating our politics for the next parliamentary term. And of course, Brexit is the root cause of all the big structural changes we've seen in Westminster over the past 4 years. I do think it's important, if we think about the long-term symbolism we can see coming from this election, there is a bit of a scorched earth feel about it. We are going to be entering a new phase, and this is partly because a tremendous number of MPs are going to be standing down, including many of the sort of familiar faces, the old guard of the former status quo, that sort of centrist period of stable and secure governance under some Blair and Brown and Cameron and so on. So we will be entering a new phase. And I think it is quite sad, actually, to see this loss of experience. I do personally always think about the difference that perhaps could have been made to have had more of the former statesmen and women of those former eras, I think including the leaders themselves, in the Commons during this Brexit maelstrom.
The first few days of the campaign were not very auspicious at all, and were especially blighted, I think, for the Conservatives by an appalling series of gaffes, And then, of course, the very same sorts of issues came flooding in from the Labour side as well, issues with candidate selection and so on, because it is, of course, a very hastily called election. I think things appear to have calmed down a little bit now, with so many of the leading party figures effectively benched for the campaign, and I think the party machines seem to be tightening their control. For Labour, there's, of course, everything to suggest that the party will continue to find itself fighting battles about its fundamental character under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, including the ongoing scandal of the proliferation of anti-Semitism in the party. The Tories, of course, themselves are seeking to overturn their nasty party reputation in seats that have never turned blue before in their history. I think one thing for certain is that it will be very much a digital campaign, and probably quite a dirty one at that. We've already seen the dissemination of a lot of misinformation, maliciously edited videos and so on. So the fact checkers are working overtime, but it's unclear as to what kind of impact they can really have.
I think it's true that the tone of the campaign will also be incredibly populist and coming in from all sides. So in 2017, we had this sort of astonishingly nostalgic campaign when we had Corbyn up against May. And there was a sprinkling, of course, of populism in that as well. But this time we just have two rather egregious examples of blatant populism from the left and the right, both railing against a different conception of the establishment. What's very interesting is Johnson is trying to run two campaigns simultaneously. He's, of course, attempting to weave them together, but they are quite distinct. The first is his Parliament versus the People campaign, which is sort of depicting the Remainer Parliament as deliberately obstructive to achieving his Brexit deal. The second is his pivot to domestic policy. And this is really consequential because he is trying to really pull off the brakes of austerity and seeking to inject a kind of level of spending into public services that we just have not seen previously from Conservative prime ministers. It really is a step change. And it's something that began under Theresa May, of course, his predecessor. But this is really clearly one of the lessons that the Conservatives took from the referendum campaign, that there are a lot of people unhappy with the long-term impacts of austerity, particularly on communities. And, you know, for his part, of course, Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, is, of course, running a populist campaign from the other side of things, aimed at the 1%. He's promising an extraordinary level of state spending, including the renationalization of industries, but also to give the state a much bigger role in the mediation of markets, big and small, whether that's curbing bankers' pay or regulating landlords in the rental market. So this campaign is likely to be dirty. It is going to be digital, and it will be very negative and populist in tone.
So if you look at it from the outside, and if you follow what some of the international media is saying about this British election, they confirm basically what you're saying right now about Jeremy Corbyn going in one direction and Boris Johnson going in the other direction. But would you say that this is a sort of signs of a lasting trend, a lasting development in British politics, where you would on the one hand have sort of a Conservative Party which is becoming more perhaps nativist, more communitarian, focusing much less on traditional economic issues that we've heard from a long time from the Tory party, the sort of economic liberalism that partly defined it in the past, and that on the other hand, we're going to have a Labour Party which is coming more dirigist and emphasizing far more about economic interventionism, and perhaps becoming this party which is more cosmopolitan, which is going to lose support outside the major cities and the major university towns.
I think we can draw some really interesting parallels with what's been taking place in the United States with the sort of voter sorting we've seen with the Republican Party and the Democrats, and of course where the leadership are taking them. In the United States, I suppose the difference is you have very much an entrenched two-party system. We, of course, have first past the post here that does favor the major parties, but we do now have a little bit more of a tradition of a third and fourth party potentially being able to form a coalition and having some sort of kingmaker influence there. So I think we are seeing a tremendous degree of voter volatility taking place in Britain. Over the past sort of 3 or 4 years, as many as half of the electorate have voted for a different party, which is just astonishing. So there is a real step change taking place here. And I think we have to consider what might take place in this election, which could be quite a significant realignment. As you say, I think the referendum has really reshaped identity and political identity in Britain. We're now seeing that voters leave or remain identity is their most strongly held. So it certainly is eclipsing some of the more traditional party affiliations that they may have held, whether that's Labour or Tories or so on. So I think the Conservatives have made themselves the party of Brexit. They're really doubling down on that message. They are trying their hardest to infiltrate many of the more traditional Labour-held areas in the country, but which voted Leave. And this is why you see them really pushing a deeply unusual program of spending, public spending on services, and also a very strong approach of localism. They've been emphasizing towns, investments, strengthening communities, and so on. So this is a key message for them. At the same time, Labour is increasingly becoming the party of the urban metropolises. It's very much now concentrating its base in university towns and large cities, and cities with large ethnic minority populations, and so on. So again, it is taking on a very distinctive persona, which is some way away from the broad church of its past. These voters who used to be loyal Labour voters, we're seeing some movement from them into the Brexit Party, potentially into the Conservatives, and also some just choosing not to vote at all. That is something that we will probably see, a sort of changing makeup of the non-voters as well. At the same time, it's not only the Labour Party which is sort of being affected by this voter volatility and movement. The Conservative Party may well see an exodus of the more liberal-leaning internationalist voters that have been so important for them. And I, of course, have been thinking about what all of this means for the foreign policy approaches of the various parties. And I think you have a very distinct profile of Labour and Conservative voters before this election, but Labour and Conservative voters on foreign policy after this election might be quite distinct. If the Conservatives lose this most liberal internationalist wing, and we do see a homecoming of the sort of UKIP and Brexit Party voters, the base that both of the leaders could be presiding over after the election could be quite significantly different. And a lot of the sort of received wisdom of the past may not stand anymore.
So what type of internationalism do you see, if any internationalism at all, is going to come out of the two different parties? So if, for instance, the Conservative Party is going to get a lot more Brexit voters and lose that liberal internationalist group that you mentioned, what would that mean in practice? Would it mean sort of anti-internationalism, anti-globalism, like sort of traditional Nigel Farage, Donald Trump style type of rhetoric? Or would it rather mean that they're going to put the emphasis on some forms of internationalism rather than other forms? Equally, sort of on the centre-left, with the shift in the Labour Party towards the more sort of extreme part of the left, how does that sort of link up with traditional internationalist views in the UK, whether that's going to be with trade and foreign aid, with NATO and military presence in different parts of the world?
So this election is quite distinct in that the electorate is being presented with a quite diverse range of positions on foreign policy. And certainly if you go back 10 years ago, say, there were many elements of our foreign policy that held a greater degree of almost cross-party consensus, really. If you look at the loyal Conservative voters, and certainly as they stand before this election, what's really interesting about them is that aside from the EU, they're actually very much in favour of multilateral governance, and considerably more so than Labour voters. So they are more internationalist, they do want us to take a strong role in the world, and so on. Labour voters For their part, a little bit less interested in many of these sort of areas of multilateralism. They're particularly skeptical of NATO, probably because its sort of symbolism in terms of nuclear weapons. They're also a little bit skeptical of our membership of the Commonwealth, which I think they sort of see as a legacy of the British Empire. It's something that does set them apart from conservative voters is that they want a very strong values emphasis on our foreign policy approach. And I think this is where we will see the Labour Party positioning itself in this campaign as a leader on climate change, humanitarian crises, refugees, and so on, to an extent that we probably won't see with the Conservative Party. I mean, Johnson, for his part, is very keen to push values. He does want us to lead on climate change and women's education and so on. But I think there will always be in the Conservative Party a stronger emphasis on sort of economic and security interests than there will be in the Labour Party. It will be very interesting to see how these sort of shifts and movements in the voting bases will impact the internationalist nature of both of the parties. As I said earlier, I think it is certainly within the realm of possibility that you may end up with a Conservative Party after the election presiding over a voting base where this idea of a global Britain, which they've been very keen to promote, is perhaps a little more contested amongst their voting base. And I think for Labour, we could actually see a Labour government under Jeremy Corbyn. I think in many ways, sort of the structural fundamentals will stay the same, but there'll be a lot of sort of symbolic acts of particularly reevaluating many of our relationships, for example, with Israel, with Saudi Arabia, and so on. And I think certainly the transatlantic relationship with Donald Trump will be a point of huge sort of symbolic protest. But I do think that actually, interestingly, he probably could see Jeremy Corbyn even taking an approach not dissimilar to that Donald Trump himself has taken, sort of starting to move beyond our traditional conceptions of allies and foes, moving into more of a grey area. I personally would see that as quite dangerous, of course, because autocrats are only too happy to take advantage of any sort of vacuums we may create. I think, in short, a quite significant realignment of the voting base between the parties, and particularly if we see an exodus of the liberal internationalist wing from the Conservative Party or a Corbyn-led government coming to power, there could be a quite significant step change in our approach to our role in the world.
Finally, Sophia, in light of what you've just said, what advice would you give to European politicians and policymakers that are thinking about what type of relation they are going to have to Britain? On the one hand, we have this fear, or at least this notion, particularly strong among some, that Britain is going to become this, you know, free market entrepôt a la Hong Kong or Singapore, that they're going to cut corporate taxes, cut regulation, and do free trade deals with America and with China and with the growing part of the world. And as a consequence of that, some of these Europeans are going to say that, well, we need to be careful about what type of integration we want with Britain, because we don't want them to, you know, enjoy the benefits of the European market, and we cannot give them free trade access of the kind that we've given Canada, because an open, free market-oriented Britain like that would just sort of steal jobs, sales from firms. On the other hand, when I'm listening to you now, and when I also follow the British debate right now, I don't really see much of that specter or that notion being very present in the British. A good part of this liberalist internationalist wing is leaving the Conservative Party. They are becoming a little bit more, as you say, focused on localism. And now we have many of these issues that regards the National Health Service and pure domestic policies. And even when issues like a free trade agreement with the United States comes up right now, I get the feeling that even conservative politicians are a bit hesitant about associating themselves too closely with that. They are pretty quick to repudiate anyone who comes out to say that, you know, if we do a free trade deal with America, well, we need to privatize NHS and we need to have chlorinated chicken here, etc. Coming back to my question, what would be your advice to European politicians and policymakers that are thinking about this issue? What type of Britain are we going to find in terms of their willingness to prefer some forms of international cooperation over others?
Well, I do think it really depends tremendously on the outcome of this election, which is quite ambiguous. I think a hung parliament is still definitely within the realm of strong possibility. So even the largest party may not necessarily be the one remaking Britain in their image. But I do think that Britain, and certainly in some elements of the Tory circles in Westminster, I think there is this sort of kind of Thatcherite, Reagan-era sort of nostalgia, Anglo-Saxon nation, where the transatlantic special relationship held sort of outsized importance. I think what there is a slow consciousness and awakening of is the fact that actually Britain and British society has become a lot more European over recent decades. And certainly in terms of our attitude towards sort of collective provision of welfare and the sort of types of standards and regulations and so on, and even the sort of issues, attitudes towards climate change and animal welfare and so on, and farming and agriculture that you see in Britain today, there is a much stronger alignment with Europe. So I think there is a sort of crisis of consciousness and identity that we will see in play in the aftermath of the election. I think certainly there are some of those within the Conservative Party that would like to see Brexit as an opportunity to, as you say, sort of remake ourselves as a kind of Singapore on sea. But I think the reality of where the British people are is that this is a country that demand high standards of welfare, agriculture, environmental standards, and so on. I think that any party that underestimates the social dimensions of this conversation that we will soon be having on trade does so at their own peril. Certainly, there is a whole ecosystem of various constituencies of lobby groups and umbrella groups and so on for all of these different industries, employment rights and so on, the unions who are ready to go. And I think that we will see a moderation of some of this rhetoric when the cold, hard realities start to set in. The truth is that Britain will necessarily be constantly triangulating, I think, certainly over the next 5-10 years, between alignment with the United States and alignment with Europe. And certainly as Europe seeks to take a much stronger sort of cohesive role in the world and see itself as a big global player, Britain will need to be reevaluating its relationships, and I think it will be sort of moving on an issues by issues basis between the two. We actually saw a bit of the tea leaves of this at the G7 summit, where there was much anticipation of how Johnson may approach this. It was the sort of first big meeting with all the EU leaders and Trump there, and it was sort of quite a fractious environment outside, and there was a sort of feeling that he may use this to really throw in his chips with Donald Trump. But actually what we saw was quite a deft maneuvering between the two on an issues by issues basis, and I think that really does suggest which way things might go in the future.
Sophia, that was a great conversation. Thank you very much for participating in our podcast.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.